Do you ever struggle with the question, if God is good, why is there suffering? We unpack this timeless question in a free chapter download from Why You Can Believe. It's called Why Does God Allow Suffering? And it's honest, hopeful, and deeply personal. From free will to a broken world, to the way suffering can lead us to God, this chapter will equip you with real biblical insight. Get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources.
Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. This is the show every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio as part of Faith Explored that helps to get you thinking and brings you conversations that matter between Christians and non-Christians. Delighted to have you with me, and we've got something very special for you today. I've just returned this week from a fabulous event down in Wadebridge in Cornwall, Creation Fest UK, and I was there both speaking, talking about Unbelievable the book, why after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. That's available right now. Special signed editions of the book, by the way, from our website, unbelievablebook.co.uk, but also to share a very special live audience edition of Unbelievable. So let's cross to the Creation Fest site for today's special edition of the show. You're unbelievable. Well, good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable Live at Creation Fest 2017 in Cornwall. Can we have a big cheer from the Creation Fest audience? Wow. Goodness me. You did brilliantly, guys. Well done. Today, our debate subject on the Unbelievable show is why I'm a Christian, why I'm an atheist, and we're going to be hearing in conversation Andy Bannister and Mark Preedy. To introduce myself, I'm Justin Brierley, host of Premier Christian Radio's weekly faith discussion show and podcast, Unbelievable. We bring Christians and non-Christians together every week for conversations that matter. And today we're recording this show in front of a live audience at Creation Fest in Wadebridge, Cornwall. It's a summer festival that's been running for over 15 years in the West Country. And if you want to find out more about the show, do check out our website. You can find over 10 years' worth of archive conversations on our podcast. That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can also read about the story of the show and why, after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian in a book I released recently. It's called Unbelievable, and it's going to be available actually straight after the conversation this afternoon from the table here if you'd like to buy a copy, and I'll even sign it if you want me to as well. We're here in the Showcase Cafe venue and site, and today on this live show I'm joined by my Christian guest Andy Bannister. Andy is one of the speakers at Creation Fest this week. Anybody been to any of Andy's sessions? Give us a hand. Yeah, okay, so some of you know who he is already, but for those who don't, he's a part of the Solus Centre for Public Christianity, based up in Dundee, Scotland. He's also the author of The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, published by Monarch. I'm sure that's available down in the resources area. Solus-cpc.org to find out more about Andy. Our non-Christian guest today, and we're so privileged to have him join us today, because it is a bit like wandering into the lion's den, but in reverse, in a way, Mark, coming along to Creation Fest. But Mark Preedy is here from Cornwall Humanists. So Mark identifies as a humanist. We're going to be finding out what that is, what that means. Doesn't believe in God. And humanists generally say we've got the responsibility to make our own meaning and morality in a world that we find ourselves in. Mark doesn't claim to be an author or speaker. He's just, an average guy. He's a handyman. He's also got a passion for sailing, I found out earlier in the day. And he's a dad too. If you want to find out more about the group he's representing, go to cornwallhumanists.org.uk. In fact, I think we have a few more Cornwall humanists in the audience. There we go, right down at the front, the keen ones. So thank you very much for joining us, and thank you, whether you're a Christian or not a Christian, in the audience today. And I know that Creation Fest certainly attracts people from across the spectrum. You're very welcome to today's conversation. I hope you enjoy what you're about to hear, because we're really about creating these kinds of conversations on the show. So I think this is going to be a very down-to-earth and well-grounded discussion on why Andy, on the one hand, is a Christian and Mark is a humanist, where they both find meaning, purpose, value and morality in life. And we're going to be inviting your questions towards the end of the show as well. So do store those up. And after we've had some conversation up here on the stage, we'll be crossing to you for your questions for Andy and Mark today. Welcome along to this live edition of Unbelievable, Andy and Mark. Great to have you with me.
Great to be here.
Perhaps we'll start with you, Mark, and just get a little bit of your background. So you're a humanist. Tell us, what is a humanist, and are the Cornish versions different to the rest of the world?
I don't think so. Humanist is just a simple outlook on life that is obviously based on just being human and having the values that we hold together, and we can come together to talk about and agree on best ways to live to further the flourishing and the well-being of everybody in this room and everyone in this planet. So I think Cornwall humanism for me was just to meet like-minded people within the area and to further the work that basically the British humanists do, which was I was a member of the British Humanists first, more through I was a member of the National Secular Society, so becoming politically aware as I got older, coming from not really a religious background in any such
And in terms. That sense, has God ever figured kind of in your life, or have you kind of grown up never really believing in God or anything to do with church?
I mean, I suppose at school you had church. I went to a church school, so I know the Lord's Prayer off by heart, but that shows you what indoctrination does. But then there's my mum was more into paranormal, so more into listening to people that said they can read the or speak to the dead or read the future.
Okay, so spiritualism and that kind of thing.
Supernatural ideas. So, and I was into that into some degree. I grew up in Essex, so things like reading tea leaves was quite common around the area that I live. So Ouija boards were used. I can remember my brother coming home quite upset after a Ouija board experience that scared a bit out of everyone doing it. So I can remember him crying all night and upsetting me. Mm. And afterwards, you know, as I grew older, I got into more critical thinking as I went through my A-levels in university.
So when you kind of look back on that now, do you sort of... You don't think anyone thinks supernatural was going on? It was sort of more psychological or something?
Yeah, I think that's... people always look for answers, looking for explanations that they can't put down to, and that's just one form of that. So especially with the uncertainty of what happens after life, after
and,
death.
And you're a dad, and you're also a keen sailor. I believe you've even sailed around the world back in the day.
Yeah.
Where did this passion come from?
I went sailing, funny enough, in Scotland, western Scotland. I lived in Belfast for a little while and went with some friends up to a place called Tarbert on the West Highlands of Scotland. I just loved the sailing. It is a real release from the pressures of everyday life, getting away sailing. And for me, it really concentrated the importance of being, of having a good structure on the boat and getting on with people and seeing the world. So I ended up... I used to work on a whale research boat, so I've sailed around Maldives, Mauritius, Seychelles, Sri Lanka, all up the Red Sea.
It gives you an amazing insight into different
some
places
things,
in the world as well,
yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us for the conversation today, and we're looking forward to digging into it in the rest of the time we've got together. Andy Bannister is our Christian guest on the program today. Andy, welcome back. You're no stranger to Unbelievable.
No stranger to Unbelievable, but always good to be here, Justin. And great to be here doing the live version, because normally we do this in a tiny little box in London, but they have actually let you out for a
I'm
few
out
hours,
of my box.
Which surprises me. Yeah,
So anyway, Andy, for those who aren't familiar with your story, do you also give us a potted history of your background?
Yeah, so my kind of sort of a potted history is I grew up in a Christian family, and but it really didn't sort of make much sense to me into my teens, and then had a sort of more sort of powerful conversion experience into wanting to make that something that was personal to me in my late teens. But then kind of bumbled along, really not thinking critically about my faith or life at all, until in the late 1990s, I began dialoguing and engaging with Muslims in London at a place called Speaker's Corner, part of Hyde Park in London. And I found my new Muslim friends very quick to ask me all kinds of questions about what I believed, and in fact specialize in tearing what I believed to pieces.
Mm.
And that suddenly forced me to the realization I need to begin discovering whether the things that I've been brought to be raised are true, Because as parents, I'm a dad, like Mark's a dad. You know, parents are well-meaning. Sometimes they tell you things that are true. Sometimes they tell you things that aren't. And that little journey that began in Speaker's Corner led then eventually to a degree in theology and philosophy, and actually to a PhD in Quranic studies.
Wow.
So I'm a somewhat unusual Christian that my PhD is in the Quran, and I've read the Quran in Arabic and studied it. So I spent sort of 20, 25 years then engaging with people of all ideas and none. And then through events like this and dialogues like the one that Mark and I are going to have this afternoon, had the privilege of talking to amazing men and women around the world who believe many different things and in some cases no things. So the last one event I did like this was a few weeks ago in Canada with a leading Canadian secularist, and we had a fantastic dialogue there on rights and meaning and purpose. So I think these conversations really matter. That's what animates me.
And Mark gave us a kind of a very brief definition of what it means to be a humanist, you know, that to believe we're all part of the human race and that we've got to get along as best we can. What's, if you could boil it down into a simpler a way as that, what does it mean to be a Christian?
Well, to be a Christian is to believe that the claims that Jesus Christ made for himself were true, that he was who he claimed to be, that he wasn't just a mere religious teacher, another first century rabbi, but was in fact God come in the flesh to deal not just with our need for ethics, and we're going to talk a bit about ethics this afternoon, but to deal with the fact there's actually something broken and twisted at the heart of the human condition, that we need more than just moral information, but we actually need transformation. So a Christian is somebody who believes that Jesus is who he claimed to be is committed their life to following him.
Well, thank you very much. Great introductions to you both. And as I say, we'll be taking some questions from the audience towards the end of today's recording. So I'm looking forward to getting into some of the questions. And this is very much a conversation, so I want you guys to feel free to just talk to each other as much as talk to me and so on. Maybe, though, we'll start with you, Andy, and say, for you, you went on this journey to sort of find out, is what I was kind of raised with true? What, in the end, were some of the key evidences that persuaded you that Christianity is the truth out of all the possible, I guess, choices that are out there, including, of course, humanism?
Well, I think one of the first things you realised that I discovered that when you talk about all the choices out there was very quickly discovery that there aren't as many choices as you think. For example, one of the questions I often grapple with on university campuses that is often thrown at me when I do university events is, you know, well, couldn't it be the case that all religions lead to God? You know, a lot of people have this idea that, well, you just, you know, as a Christian, you've simply picked one option from the smorgasbord of ideas. But one of the things that certainly studying Islam did for me was awake me to the realization that actually only one person made the claims that Jesus did. In fact, only one religion claims to be able to lead you to God. Islam, for example, my other specialism, if you read the Quran, Islam does not claim to lead you to God. It claims to lead you to heaven. But the heaven that's described there is a place where you have beautiful rivers of wine, beautiful fruit trees, rivers of wine, young women for the men and so forth. But God is very much absent. So as I began pressing into comparative religion, that quickly cleared the decks. Mm. And the options then really became, well, it's either Christianity or it's probably some form of humanism or actually probably nihilism for me. Because as I then did my philosophical studies, I became pretty rapidly convinced that if atheism follows, some things follow from that for meaning its significance. If human beings are just atoms and particles and nothing more than that, and again, that's not my language, that's the language of someone like Bertrand Russell, really leading atheist 20th century, some things follow. And so I think what I did then is I pressed very hard into Christianity, especially the claims that Jesus made and who he claimed to be, and then I pressed pretty deeply into atheism. And for those who've read my book, if not, it's on sale in the bookshop there. Quick plug. And The Atheist Didn't Exist. You'll find that probably 90% of the quotations there are from atheist writers. So it was really as I looked hard at what atheists were saying about atheism, and I looked hard at who Jesus was claiming to be, and I weighed the evidence for both of those worldviews, and especially could you live their claims out, that I came to the conclusion I think Christianity is true on the balance of evidence.
Coming back to you, Mark, I mean, in its modern expression, humanism is by and large seen as something that is the province of an atheist. You know, it's someone who doesn't believe in God tends to adopt the humanistic outlook, whereby they see life through a non-religious perspective. So, what kind of persuaded you that that's the best way of seeing life? That humanism, a non-religious perspective without God, is the best way of looking at things.
The problem with atheism and using it as a title for anything, it only says what you don't believe in.
Right.
And therefore, I mean, a lot of people here would identify as Christians, but even saying that, you still have different views on lots of different topics. So when you label people, that's why I always get reluctant to label myself as anything, really. But you have to when you have a dialogue. So I'd only say I'm an atheist if somebody starts mentioning God. Mm. And that's pretty much the only time. And the best example, is, and I'm sure everyone knows, is that it's like a stamp collector referring to everyone else as non-stamp collectors. So, and it's only a term that anybody would call themselves a non-stamp collector when they're talking to stamp collectors. But that stamp collector doesn't have anything to say, or that non-stamp collector doesn't have anything to say to the stamp collector.
Right.
There's no interest in stamps.
So in a sense, it's not that the fact that you don't believe in God is not sort of the prime thing in your life. It's kind of like the person who doesn't collect stamps defining themselves as a non-stamp collector.
I mean, I don't believe in fairies. I don't believe in poltergeists. And they don't factor into anything that I do or feel about anything in life, really. You don't need them, or you don't need to identify of a rejection or something to say that's what defines you. So you don't have to have that. And it's almost the atheist is an easy straw man to sort of attack, because it's really easy to say, lump everyone into this category of atheism and say that's what they believe. And that's what it's such a broad... It's not even a broad area. Once you're an atheist, you say an atheist, that's about all you can say. I'm an atheist. That person over there is an atheist, but it doesn't necessarily mean I have much in common.
Because not everyone who's an atheist would necessarily define themselves as a humanist as well.
I've heard Anderson talk about Nietzsche saying he's an atheist, and then quote Nietzsche as if I agree with Nietzsche, and I don't on his views on morality and so forth. So it's not a good way of saying everybody is an atheist must have these views, and they're very easy to attack.
What led you in that case then, moving away from the label atheist, to adopting humanism as a label, if you like?
Well, that's more for me as became. I was actually more interested in secularism, so I can mostly identified as a secularist before I was identified as a humanist, because I just became more aware of the secularist movement saying, when you become politically aware, I'd say that I want a fair society that doesn't, and through your government, doesn't favour any one particular view on anything, really. Unfortunately, they do, obviously, on economics and social welfare, but there's still they've got to justify it in secular language. So when somebody says, I don't agree with you, they've got to be able to use a vocabulary that everyone understands. So they can't say, well, the Bible says this or the Quran says that, and this is what our views are. And unfortunately, you do hear that. Rees-Mogg recently saying that marriage between a man and a woman is a Catholic upbringing, and I believe that. But you can't argue with it. And for me, that's where my non-belief in religion has manifested itself at the beginning, to say, right, if we're going to have a conversation, we've got to be able to have it in terms that everybody can agree, and it can't fall back on some sacred text that nobody else is going to agree with if they have opposing values.
What do you make of this particular way of the reason for humanism being it helps us to rub along better as a society in that sense?
Well, it's a couple of things, actually. I mean, the funny thing is I knew we'd have stuff in common, because people often think that atheists and Christians have to disagree about everything, but actually I knew there'd be too much.
You use the term atheist.
I know, exactly.
I think it's ingrained in you.
Well, exactly. And I think on the idea that I think atheism is on one level just the absence of a belief, I agree with you. That doesn't tell me what you do believe. The interesting thing is what has gone on. I think when you look particularly into anthropology and sociology, people who study worldviews and beliefs group the different religions of the world together. And there's really three large groupings, four large groupings. There's theism, which is religions like Islam, Christianity, and Judaism that do believe in a kind of personal God. You've got deism, which believes in a kind of God who set everything going and then disappeared off, never to be seen again. And actually, interestingly, even Richard Dawkins has said, possibly I could be convinced by deism if you mean a God who never ever shows up again. Then you've got polytheism, which is lots of gods. And then you've got atheism. And certainly if you study comparative religion at most universities, there'll be a whole family of religious beliefs and worldviews under there. So I think on that level, atheism is helpful. But then I'd agree with Mark that whenever somebody self-describes as an atheist, and I meet loads of people who do among students, my follow-up question is always, well, this tells me what you don't believe. What do you believe? And this is where humanism I think, comes in. And I'd say a couple of things with humanism. First thing, for those who are Christians in the room, to encourage you, don't be put off by the term humanism, because it used to be actually a Christian idea. If you look at the origins of humanism, it grew out of an idea. It was used to describe the sort of study of human tradition. And you can look to when the word first occurs on the landscape, and it was used to people studying the Greek classics and Greek philosophy. In fact, Erasmus, an early translator of the New Testament and a pioneer of New Testament Greek study, called himself a humanist. And today it's shifted to be often associated with a godless position, but I think I'd like to see much broader appreciation, because I think in terms of seeing humanism as people who are committed to social justice and human flourishing and the common good, I think those are wonderful things. Whether you can get those out of a godless world is possibly where Mark and I would disagree, but that it's good to pursue those things, I think humanists and Christians would have a lot of common ground. But on the secular public square, one last thing to say where Mark landed. I always love saying a couple of things. It gives you wiggle room in case you think of another way while you're going. Again, what's interesting, I think it's interesting to look where the idea of secularism began. Again, it was really partly a Christian invention, because Christians had, unfortunately, Christian history is sadly full of Christians squabbling over things and sometimes sadly killing one another over things. Look at the history of the Protestants and the Catholic churches here in the UK, and it's a bit of a bloody sordid history. And actually it was Christian politicians and the Christian state at that point beginning to step in and go, right, we've got to start creating some space. So the state no longer begins legislating and saying, okay, we're going to allow you guys to kill one another over this. Actually, that's a good thing. That's a Jesus thing, actually. Jesus had a lot to say about religion and politics, and one thing he said is don't mix the two. So in some senses, Jesus was a secularist. Where I have a problem, and I don't hear this language from you, Mark, so I genuinely appreciate this, I think if we were talking about creating a space where we can sit down and discuss what we hold dear and bring what we hold dear to the table, because we can't separate our religious ideas from who we are. You know, it'd be unfair for me to say to Mark, let's have a discussion, but by the way, leave your humanism at the door. Or for me as a Christian, leave my Christianity at the door, or to my Muslim friends. I'd love to see ways we can create a space where we can talk about what we really believe, recognize we all have beliefs, we all have commitments, we all have a faith, and take one another seriously, but without privileging one position or another. And if that's what humanism means, if that's the secularism, then I'm actually in favor of that.
Mm. I mean, coming back to you, Mark, do you think there's any value in the Christian tradition? Do you find that, you obviously don't believe in God, but would you be okay with there being a God? Is that something that if someone could show you it were true, you'd be open to, you'd think is a good thing? Or are you kind of indifferent about the whole thing?
I wouldn't. I suppose that's the definition of what a God would be. We don't know. There's no way of knowing What kind of God could make anything different to what the ideals of humanism would be.
Okay.
So I can't see any addition or any benefit from having that God.
What are the ideals you think of then in terms of humanism that for you obviously don't require a God for people to accept?
I think that's the fairness and equality of everybody and ideas and so forth. So if somebody, just treating people fairly and equally, and that's, giving everyone the dignity and the courtesy of compassion and empathy that we all have, but still identify that we are capable of doing things wrong and getting it wrong, and the only way of correcting that really is by acknowledging those mistakes and difficulties, but also identifying the goodness and the possibility for bettering ourselves through better understanding and actually honesty and actually pushing those ideals forward. And so I can't see anything that is added by any kind of external. I don't think we need an external force to say that that's what you should be doing.
Right.
It's. I'm sure everybody here who puts their hands up that doesn't agree with that last statement.
I mean, so for you, it's almost like it's just a self-evident thing that that's the way we should treat each other.
I think as humans, if we think about things enough and come to the... I can't see how you can't come to that idea if you actually think about it enough. And there's no need to have an enforcement or a...
Or a set of rules in a book or whatever.
It's really quite simple, really. You've got to come to those...
Why can't we just all be humanists? Just by seeing that that's the way things work best, Andy.
Yeah, that's a great question, and one I hear quite a lot. And I think, you know, for me, one of the most important things we can think about as human beings is whether something is true. And so it may be a nice idea that we all hug one another and go, hey, I'm human. Hey, you're human. Isn't it wonderful? There's a few problems follow from that. One is, of course, the idea that human beings have value and dignity. I really appreciate that Mark used the word dignity. I think dignity is one of the most important human ideas, because if you look at someone who's different from you, who believes differently to you, and still see them as a man or woman bearing dignity, we're off to a great start. But, of course, the problem is we tend to have very short historical imaginations, and we forget where these ideas come from. And so Luc Ferry, who's a French atheist writer, one of the most eminent French philosophers writing today, wrote a wonderful little book called A Brief History of Thought, and he surveys about 2,000 years of philosophical tradition and traces ideas through history. And he's actually got quite a few positive things to say about the Christian faith. He's very clear he doesn't think Christianity is true, but I just wanted to read something he says, because it's very pertinent to this. He says, he notes that in the Greco-Roman world, it was taken as a given that people were inferior to others. Aristotle famously believed slaves, women, children were inferior. In fact, Ferry points out, in every civilization we know of had slavery. The Romans had it, the Greeks had it, the Persians had it, Africans had it before Europeans came and imposed their version. And then Luke writes these words. He says, in direct contradiction to the Greek world, Christianity was to introduce the notion that humanity was fundamentally identical, that humans were equal in dignity. This was an unprecedented idea at the time, not one that was obvious and one to which our world owes its entire democratic inheritance. But this notion of equality did not come from nowhere. And he fleshes out in the book the problem we have and the unique observation of Christianity was, in one sense, Aristotle was in many ways right. Human beings are born in different stations of life. Justin is a best-selling author. He's made millions of pounds selling his book.
That's not true, by the way.
I am but a poor, humble lecturer, and Justin clearly has more power and influence than I do. Some people are born into poverty. Some people are born into riches and power. Some people have huge ability to wield influence over others. Other people don't, and so on and so forth. It's demonstrably not the case that all people are born equal. On top of that, if we are nothing more than the collection of materials and the genes that make us up, Luke presses into in his book, he says some things do flow from that. Just look at what's happened. Look what happened with eugenics, for example, when people tried to push the whole Darwinism thing that little bit too far. And so it's interesting that someone as eminent as Luke Ferry says Christianity was the one we have to thank for this. But the question then raises: is it true? Is it true? You know, is Mark just a 1% bit of pollution, as Lawrence Krauss would say? Or are you a person with actual dignity and actual value? I think that question is not an unimportant one.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
You're listening to a special edition of Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon, recorded live at Creation Fest in Wadebridge, Cornwall this past week. A completely free event that takes place every summer. But it's not too late to get involved in Creation Fest Scotland, happening on Saturday the 26th of August this summer, 12 p.m. till 8 p.m. You can find out more about it at creationfest.org.uk. We'll be back with the rest of the conversation between my Christian guest on the show this week, Andy Bannister, and our humanist guest, Mark Preedy. He drew thousands to hear him. His stories are still told 2,000 years on, and his words are the most famous in the world. Jesus was a brilliant communicator. But why? In the latest Premier Christianity magazine, we reveal what he knew about your brain and how it can help you to communicate like Christ. Plus, Governor B asked whether culture needs to become more unpopular. We talk to the parliamentary priest, Rose Hudson-Wilkin, and find out how to be brave when the world is a war zone, from a pastor at the centre of the Manchester attack. All that plus much more. Ask for your free sample copy at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to this week's Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. As part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio every Saturday afternoon, this is the show that brings you conversations that matter between Christians and non-believers. If you want to check out our show archive, do go to the website, premierchristianradio.com patreon.com/unbelievable. Join the thousands who download the podcast every week and find out more about the show. There's the DVD and MP3 CD of this year's Unbelievable Conference that's available to order right now. You can also find out more about the book I've written telling the story of the show and why I'm still a Christian after all these conversations with skeptics and atheists. That's all available from premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And with something very special on the show this week, I was down at Creation Fest in Wadebridge, Cornwall, speaking and also leading a live audience version of the show. It was great to be joined by hundreds of people in the Showcase Cafe at Creation Fest this past week. And if you're listening because you were there, then welcome along to Unbelievable. Let's continue, though, with the conversation we had there, why I am a Christian, why I am a humanist, Andy Bannister and Mark Preedy.
So I guess the challenge then to you at this point, Mark, is human equality, dignity and value isn't something that simply appears in all cultures and times and places. As far as, you know, Andy sees it, it's something we can thank Christianity for, you know, in the Judeo-Christian of the West, Judeo-Christian tradition of the West. Are you confident, though, that we would come to these conclusions if we just sort of used our common sense and intellect?
I think so. If you're allowed... in history, I mean, humanism has come about directly, correctly, sort of from a Christian source in a way that at a time when the Renaissance was rediscovering the works of likes of Aristotle and Socrates and Plato and so forth, they were discovering that via the Muslim tradition of copying those books that were actually suppressed by the original Christian church. All the Epicureans and the Plato school of philosophy were all closed by the Christian authorities, and the suppression of those books and information and ideas was completely put down for, well, it was 1500 years or so, or 1000 years at least. And it wasn't until the rediscovery of them that these ideas of equality were again surfacing, and it was because of the printing press and the publication of books and copying of these ideas that Christianity had to respond, really. And it's...
Are you saying that the Christianized West kind of lost this?
Yeah, why didn't Christianity come up with those in 600 or 800 or 1000 AD? So it's come about through pressure from other ideas, from other sources, not the reading of the Christian Bible. It's come through interpretations with new information. What's happened there. So, and to be non-Christian in the 1700s or 1500s was very, which is just impossible. You couldn't get a tenureship at any university.
It's inevitable that the ideas that flourished came from a Christian background.
And I think those ideas first were in the Muslim tradition as well, but they were suppressed there, and that's why...
So there's a couple of things here, Andy, that Christianity has a bad record in Mark's view of suppressing ideas and only had to kind of face up to these ideas from history when they were kind of put back in the public sphere. And as far as he can see, it hasn't always had the best record at affirming the intrinsic dignity and value of humans.
That's a great observation. Let me take it in two ways. The first idea that Mark shared was the sort of not really a polite term for it, I'm afraid, but it's a myth. There's actually the Dark Ages, which is what Mark kind of described there, is no longer taken seriously by historians. So if you Google the myth of the Dark Ages, you'll discover vast amounts of material. In fact, nobody believes any longer that Aristotle and Plato and such things had really been lost. They were still being talked about. And in fact, even within the Muslim tradition that you talk about, I mean, obviously Islam has a wonderful history of philosophy. I mean, as a philosopher who was studying Islam for 15 years, there have been some kind of real riches there. But actually, what's interesting and often missed, most of those who were doing the work on Aristotle and Plato and such things within the Muslim world were actually Christians and Jews, because what happened when Islam expanded out of Arabia following Muhammad's death in 632 AD, under the Islamic conquest, a lot of former Christian lands fell very quickly to the Muslim armies as Islam conquered the former Byzantine Empire. And basically what happened was Islam did a wonderful job of hoovering up scholarship. And what's interesting, a lot of Muslim philosophers that would be famous here in the West, if you dig into their histories, were actually Christian and Jews, who, to be fair, were given the permission to carry on studying and doing their work under Islam. And in fact, the problems really kicked off when actually the Islamic world discovered what was going on. And we have Al-Ghazali, who was a Muslim philosopher, died. He's got the easiest death date in history. He died in 1111. And he wrote a book called The Incoherence of the Philosophers. And he squashed a lot of this philosophy that was going on. But until that point, Jews and Christians are still carried on doing it. In terms of some of the ways that Christians have behaved in history, though, I'm really glad Mark raised that point, because I'd be the first to say, I think absolutely, I think there have been times when the church has behaved appallingly. I don't think anyone with half a brain, half a historical brain, would say there's not a problem here. I think one of the interesting things about having these kind of conversations in the public square today is all of us have embarrassing moments in our history. Our Muslim friends have the conquests that they need to face up to. Christianity, we have the Crusades, and some of what went on in suppression of particularly different sectarian positions, the Protestant Catholic history here in the UK. I was based in Oxford for a while, and as you walk through the middle of Oxford, you pass a thing called the Martyrs Memorial, where Latimer, Ridley, and I always forget the third, were burnt there for their Protestant beliefs. And then, of course, for our atheist and humanistic friends, there have been times when that tradition and those beliefs have been used to cause incredible damage. And so for me, the question
That's not a human. If you're referring to what are you saying, Stalin wasn't
a
humanist.
I would refer to a number of things. I would refer to, for example, I'd refer to Stalin.
He's not a humanist. He's an atheist. That's why the atheist is easy to.
Well, I know. I love
he's
the
not
approach
a humanist.
To
he's not a humanist. Well, you can't say he was on an
idea. In one sense, Mark, what I would gently suggest you would be guilty of doing would be fishing the bits out of atheist and secular history that you like, and ignoring others. And I think it's important to live up to our tradition. So, for example, let me give you a good example. Now, this may not apply to you, but when I was in Toronto, I remember speaking at one of the humanist groups there. And up on their wall, they had a picture of great minds from the history of humanism. Hanging there on the wall was H.G. Wells, as an example of a great humanist. And I remember my colleague, there were two of us doing the discussion, had the sort of nous to stop partway through and say, "Is that H.G. Wells up there?" And they said, "Oh, yes, yes." And the president spoke quite proudly about him. My colleague then said, "Just out of interest, are you aware of his views on eugenics and sterilizing those who hadn't got the right IQ and his views on race?" Pretty uncomfortable reading. And I'm not tarring you with this.
I've said humans are not infallible, but when that's why atheism is not a description. I'm not avoiding the fact that Stalin and other atheists that have used an ideology. And it's interesting, Stalin was obviously ideology. He had an ideology of Marxists who obviously had humanist ideals. So he had an ideal of fairness. So I accept that. So I don't get. But you can't lump humanism with atheism in Stalin's example. And I don't think. I'm not cherry picking there. And I think that's unfair of you.
No,
that's disingenuous, really.
I guess the point is that humanism in the mode that you occupy it is a relatively recent phenomenon in that sense.
I think
and
that's
and
fair,
so,
yeah.
So, in a sense, it's one of the more recent sort of ways of seeing things from a.
I mean, it's still older than Stalin's existence. I mean, it is a slow building ideal, but it's not. The very function of the very belief of humanism is to do. One of its tenets is do no harm or do a little harm. So that very tenet outlaws that very prescription
the things
to say
that
if you don't
did.
Agree with me, I'm going to kill you. It can't happen.
I think this brings us neatly though onto the whole question of how we live in and justify the moral world that we espouse. So. You're a humanist and you have this deep-seated belief in the dignity and equality and value of humans in that sense. And I think Andy's challenge to you is, these ideas don't just occur to everybody. You know, there have been many cultures and times where they have not had that view of humanity. They may have had great learning and education, but they certainly didn't view humans as equal. That's something that came by and large in the West, at least through a Christian, Judeo-Christian understanding of what it is to be human. So what, I mean, do you think we would have got to this place without any help in that sense? Do you think it isn't something people would naturally gravitate towards what, regardless of their Christian history?
I think it's always going to be hard to be able to justify anything with hindsight and think where we are now. In the values that we all hold, most probably share as common, just from being westernised, as in we think democracy.
And what do you say to the person, say, in another place in the world who doesn't share your view? and says, I do believe that women are inferior to men, for instance,
yeah.
Or whatever it may be. How do you say, no, you ought to believe the same thing as I believe as a humanist?
Well, I think that's where the social justice, say, John Rawls comes in. And if you ask people to make a judgment about who they are and how they would govern others with the veil of ignorance and say, if you don't know where you're going to stand in society, what do you think the laws of society should be? And if you look at you know, the hierarchy of everybody, they say there's in the pre-democracy you'd have a king. Even in those times, he said, would you take the risk, say, well, I want to be governed by a king and an overlord, with the risk of you likely to be a lord or an overlord or a king yourself would be obviously
very small,
yeah. Compared to being just a worker on the ground. And I think if you just take that observance, that's where this common value...
So in a sense, this idea you're expressing that by John Rawls was, if none of us knew what station we were going to occupy in life before we arrived on planet Earth, we would actually, on average, choose... That whatever station I was born into, I was given the most access to the same rights and privileges as everyone else.
Yeah,
so that's kind of where you see the...
I know that's not an easy... That's not an easy way to... There's no easy way to say how would that come about in societies. And we're quite fortunate. I don't think there's only been... there's never been an organised group saying this is what's going to happen. It's always been a fight to make it that way because... Every form of governance favours themselves to be in power, you know. So that's why it's been such a slow process from original ideas. They were original ideas. The Greeks came up with some of the ideas. They obviously kept slaves themselves, so they obviously didn't quite see it that way. But the more we've looked at it, and the longer we've gone on, we can see it applies to everyone. And say slavery is unfair. And even say, in history they might not have known it was unfair. I'm sure the people that were slaves didn't agree with it. they never had a voice or ability to overcome that idea of slavery or, you know, unfair station in life. So,
okay. I mean, so this is the perspective Mark takes that, you know, if you applied some kind of a thought experiment to life, like that famous thought experiment of John Rawls, and said, what would you choose if you didn't know where you were going to end up in the human race? And we would all choose the most amount of equality and fairness we could muster. Is that a good way of from a non-religious perspective, coming to the view that we're all equal, we should all treat each other with inherent dignity and so on?
Yeah, it's one of those ideas that sounds lovely in practice. You know, as someone who's sort of studied philosophy for years, it's one of the ideas you play out in a university classroom. And it does actually kind of work as a thought experiment.
In theory, in that sense.
In theory. It's like communism, actually. It works really well in theory. It breaks down for two reasons. One, it breaks down in the real world when you have somebody who has that power and that authority and that position who basically turns around to you and goes, well, I don't care about your Rawlsian thought experiment. I have power, and this is how I'm going to use it. I'm actually not interested. You know, to use the Joseph Stalin example, you know, it's often used as an ethical example. What could you say to Joseph Stalin to convince him he was wrong? When he could go, actually, I've got away with it. I've had a wonderful life, thanks very much. I've trampled all over everybody. I haven't had to play this Rawlsian game, so actually, thank you very much. I'll have the power. What could you say? That's an interesting question. We use that in classrooms all the time. But then I think the other related question fails to take account of the fact that what happens when human beings go wrong. You see, one of the things that interests me in the humanism tradition that Mark's representing, you know, it is very easy to come along and go, hey, humanism the human tradition has produced a whole number of things. There are things common to us as humans that are wonderful. We do have a tendency to be social and be nice to one another and generally share the scones and not bash each over the head and run off with a clotted cream. But human tradition has also produced a number of other things. Human beings are the only species on planet Earth that have invented warfare and genocide and horrible other ways of treating one another. So actually the human condition is fairly mixed. And in fact, it's reasons like that that lead someone like John Gray, who's a very well-regarded atheist philosopher, wrote a fantastic little book a few years ago called Straw Dogs, in which he basically calls humanism a religion, and even worse than that, it's a bad religion, because he says it fails to take account of the fact that the human animal is incredibly mixed. It's a pretty bleak book. You get to the end of John's book and you go, oh my gosh, where do we go from here? But I think something has to recognize this account that if human beings were all perfect and moral and good and lovely, it would be wonderful. But actually we aren't, And that's the thing we need to take account of. Communism, for example, I mentioned there. It was interesting. Communism was set up with great intentions. Produce that kind of fair society. Distribute things fairly. Ensure that all are equal. And one of the most important books of the 20th century was Alexander Solzhenitsyn's book, The Gulag Archipelago. And Alexander was a Russian political prisoner imprisoned by the communists for his political beliefs. And in that book, he very easy for him to blame his captors, to blame the Soviets, to blame the system for all that happened to him. But in that book, he says, the problem with communism is it failed to recognize the human condition. And he said, the problem is this, the dividing line between good and evil runs right through the middle of every human heart. Every one of us have the ability to be angelic, and every one of us have the ability to be monstrous. If I'd been born in a different set of circumstances, I could have been the Gulag guard. We need an ideology that faces up and is honest about that if we're going to solve some of the problems.
Do you think humanism is, in that sense, overly optimistic about the human condition, Mark?
No, I agree with what Adi was saying, and that's why humanism says you identify the frailties and accepts them, and we try and push forward and have rules that try and stop us from. So, you know, Declaration of Human Rights, for example, is a good example of that's the best way forward. So if you want to live together, then you have to abide by certain rules that we can all agree on. And I think the Declaration of Human Rights is a good starting point, but it is quite, there's issues when you get to quite nuanced perspectives of things, and then that's when you need high courts to step in and intervene and
what,
come up
what
with
ideas.
What
do you do in the real life situations, though, where dictatorships, people in power, do ride roughshod over the human rights that you hold dear?
Well, unfortunately, that's what United Nations was, and the League of Nations was originally devised to have this external force from the governments to try and say, look, you can't do that. And it does work to some extent, but unfortunately, it's been overridden by everybody and every state, because it's a self-state. And you know, at the moment, our political situation is nationalism is coming back again. And unfortunately, the idea of globalism and everybody is should be treated fairly is becoming a dirty idea, unfortunately.
Before we go to some questions, and the time has gone by so quickly, I knew it would do. I wanted to ask you some questions as well, Mark, about sort of as a humanist, where you, as someone who doesn't believe in an afterlife or a bigger purpose to the universe, I suppose. And I mean, I don't know whether you would use this language, but would you say you do regard life, our life in the universe, as essentially an accident, but that we just sort of, and in that context, what meaning are we supposed to be looking for in life? How would you define the search for meaning that I think most human beings experience? How would you say you engage with that as a humanist?
Well, that's just, you make your own meaning, you know, the things you do, the friendships you have, and how you treat yourself and others, you give meaning through that. So you get, everybody's different, we've got to accept that, and no one prescribed way of getting meaning is ever going to be acceptable. You can't lump everybody in this room and say, right, you have to follow this absolute path of happiness and meaning.
What for you gives you meaning then, on a personal level?
Just living life, enjoying my sailing. I've got a lot of just splendor of traveling around the world, meeting people, finding a good friendships, enjoying life, looking back on things and seeing. I get wonder everywhere. Sort of, and the more I learn, you know, our particles, we all come. I've got a great book for my children. It's called You Are Stardust. Mm. And that blows me away, that the only way we are here is because some star has blown up.
The chemicals that make you up were birthed
in
a star.
Stardust.
You know,
it's an extraordinary idea. That to me is just absolutely phenomenal, and it's just amazing.
How though does that give you meaning, I wonder? What is it about that fact?
That in itself doesn't give me meaning. It just shows you how splendid the universe is in that way, and that you can't really get your mind around it. So I don't try. I just accept it is there and get on with life and don't let it hang over me as an existentialist kind of angst. I accept that I'm human. We have frailties. We have ability to have joy, have laughter. And for me, friends and experiencing life. I get out as much as I can. I go surfing. I run. I love swimming, sea swimming. I love. I have to overcome the fear of sharks every time I get in the water, but that's Jaws film for you. But I get... I look I just enjoy life, and that's as much as you can do. And
I mean, no such... you've just come from a seminar talking about meaning, Andy. I have a feeling you're about to get more pessimistic. but I mean, there you go. Mark's view is we make our own meaning. I can appreciate the awesomeness of the universe that produced me, but it doesn't give me a meaning. I have to find that in the things I enjoy in life, basically.
Yeah, I think that's where you're forced to. If you take one of the beliefs that sits within that family of atheist views, of course, some interesting things follow. I mean, it's funny, the Jaws line, that's why I've always been afraid to take up surfing. But of course, if the shark comes along and has a lovely munch on Mark as you're out surfing, of course, the shark's got the same right to do that as you've got to do your thing. He's found his meaning in chowing down on a local humanist, and good luck to Jaws. As you were talking about meaning, it was just interesting that the thought that occurred to me, particularly like you mentioned you're into sailing, you know, there's an interesting illustration once given about meaning of life involving kind of sailing and ships and so forth. And the illustration goes this way. It says, you know, imagine a navy, a fleet of ships out there on the ocean. And there are three things that fleet of ships out there on the ocean needs. They need three kinds of things. They need instructions on how to keep the ships maintained. So if things break down, what do you do to fix them? And that probably equates to personal ethics. You know, how do you look after yourself? How do you live your own life in such a way that you live out the life of a good, authentic human being? Those ships also need instructions about how not to bump into one another. You know, who gives way to who? If a battleship and a destroyer are sort of, you know, on the same course, who gives way? And that sort of roughly equates to social ethics. You know, if Justin and I have a minor disagreement, how do we handle it? But there's one other thing those ships need, not just instructions on how to maintain themselves, not just instructions on how not to bump into each other. The most important thing that fleet of ships needs is a set of instructions about what the heck they're doing out there in the first place and what the mission is. Because otherwise you're likely to sail around in circles. And the whole purpose question is hugely significant. Without answering that and finding the answer to that in terms of something bigger than ourselves, we are going to sail in circles. And in fact, the single best book on morality, and this is some of the stuff we've talked about this afternoon that I can recommend, if you take one book, if you get this on Amazon, it's called Justice by a guy called Michael Sandel, S-A-N-D-E-L. Teaches, I think, at Yale or Harvard. I always forget which. And in that book, he surveys all the different options out there and rejects every single one of them. He's not a Christian, incidentally. And he comes down to land on this question of purpose, where, Justin, you asked me. And Michael's conclusion is, we are uncomfortably faced with the fact that unless we can describe what a human life is for and answer what the ancients called the question of telos, the question of purpose, then we are in real trouble. And that's an uncomfortable question, he said, because people get heated about that, but that's the conversation we need to be having. If there isn't a purpose to life, then Mark, you can pick your humanism, somebody else can pick communism, somebody else can pick nihilism, somebody else can stand on the top of a pillar and eat cream teas all day, and it's all lovely, we have no way to decide between them. But if we can answer that purpose question when Michael lands his book, then I think we can start talking about these bigger things. But that's a big conversation.
Would you describe yourself as believing in a purpose to life in that sense, Mark?
When you say purpose, you mean as if something's given you this is why you're here.
It's not something external to us in that sense.
No, really. I mean, otherwise, you know, if people have purpose, then the killer can have a purpose. Why are they killing?
Yeah.
Do you
agree with this idea, though, that Andy's, I guess, elaborated on there, that we have to somehow decide which of the different meanings on offer is the right meaning in that sense? Because obviously there are some meanings that you think are invalid, I suppose.
I think you just withhold judgment on it. Right. I mean, there's no... Without any obvious purpose, you know, it begs the question, what if that purpose... then you're going to pick and choose what you feel is a good purpose. So if you say, oh, there's a purpose giver, and then suddenly, well, if that purpose giver is going to say that purpose is good, but then also they can then say, well, the person says I've killed with a purpose to save and forward my views, that's my purpose. And some people do. I mean, they fly their planes into buildings for that purpose.
Yeah, the quick response, and then we're going to go to some questions.
Say, that's a great question Mark raised there, but of course it just raises the observation that people can get the wrong purpose. If I go to the wonderful sort of farm shop down the road from here where I was yesterday and gorged myself on cream tea, and I buy scones, and I then sort of liquidize those scones, put them into the petrol tank of my Toyota, and then the whole engine freezes up, and I go, well, hang on a minute, that's not right, I'm going to go back to that farm shop and demand money back, I think they'd quite rightly go, that's not the purpose of a scone. You've actually misunderstood what the purpose is. And I think we can disagree about purpose. We can argue about what it is. That doesn't actually mean that purpose doesn't exist. It's easy to get the wrong, you know, to misunderstand the purpose of something. And as somebody once said, look, there's only one right answer to a sum. To the answer to the question 2 + 2 = there's only one right answer. There's a near infinite number of wrong answers. Some of those wrong answers are closer than others. 5 is nearer than 1.3 million. But there is still only one answer to a sum, and I believe there is only one thing for which human beings are made. There is only one purpose of life, and of course, as a Christian, I believe that's to know Jesus Christ and enjoy him forever. Lots flows from that. But just because we can disagree about purpose doesn't mean there isn't one.
So you're saying that 2 + 2 has a purpose of being 4?
I would say the answer of a sum is to have an answer. I would say the purpose of a watch is to tell the time. I would say the purpose of a scone is to be eaten. The question is, is there a purpose to human life, Mark?
That's the thing. The idea of purpose is that you try to say there is a purpose giver. I mean, we know we've made a watch, so that's the purpose of it.
Yes.
We know that we can look at the history of watch making and say that is
exactly.
A watch for purpose. And we know the history of scone makers. Is their purpose is for you to eat it. But that's because we can directly know that purpose from that giver, i.e. the scone maker and the watchmaker. That's fine, and that's as far as we can take that. But then you can still say, well, what purpose was the scone maker making the scone? Why do you need that line to say, well...
Why does there have to be this ultimate purpose?
Right, so, the scone maker has made a scone to sell it, but was there a purpose to give that scone maker...
That particular
purpose. I mean, there's no need other than to make. They want to make money, put food. They have a reason for it, which is tangible to us. Really, it's not.
Yeah.
We'll make this the final comment.
In fact, a good analogy. Actually, I suddenly realised I've got a scone obsession this afternoon, and scones may not have been the best example. A good example I use.
Shouldn't it be Cornish pasties as you're in this part?
Exactly,
of the country,
maybe Cornish pasties. Exactly. Analogy I often use with my students is this: to go look on my desk at home. I have a rock that I picked up from a beach in Somerset. Actually, I know to say Somerset in Cornwall is to swear. I do apologise. And it's serving the purpose as a paperweight, but that of course isn't the purpose of that rock. That's what I've used it for. On the other hand, on my hand I do have a wristwatch, and that was designed with a purpose. So I can use that rock for lots of different things. If I start trying to hammer in nails with a watch, I think you can correct me. The question then comes, and this I guess is where we need to throw this open to questions, right? The question then becomes, which category does a human life fall into? Does a human life fall into, is it more like a watch, so that if you see a human being abusing another, you with your humanist lens on, goggles on, you can say, that's wrong. You shouldn't be doing that. There is something incorrect about the use of a human life to cause all kinds of atrocities. It is wrong to cause suffering. You should not be doing it. Or is a human life more like a rock, where somebody can say, well, I can use my life to cause suffering, and the best that you, Mark, can do is say, well, I don't like it, I don't approve of it, and actually, if I can get enough people to legislate against it, I will stop it, but you haven't actually done anything wrong. You haven't actually misused a life. I just disapprove.
Well, but a disapprovement comes through. You wouldn't like it done to yourself.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
You're listening to a special edition of Unbelievable. This was a live audience edition of the show recorded this last week at Creation Fest in Wadebridge, Cornwall, which is an annual Christian music festival and Bible week. And it was great to be able to lead this live audience edition of Unbelievable there at the event this past week. And we'll be back in a moment's time with the Q&A that took place after Andy Bannister and Mark Preedy had finished their conversation.
If you want to have a massive reason why human beings are special, here it is. God became one.
We can be part of God's plan to bring hope to a hopeless generation.
We're living in an exciting time to be a follower of Jesus. The golden age of Christianity, ladies and gentlemen.
We live in a universe that has a story that is ultimately about love.
There's a God-shaped hole in the heart of every person. It can only be filled by God, made known through Jesus Christ. Hear the world's leading Christian thinkers make the case for Christ at Unbelievable, the Conference 2017. Now available not only on DVD, but also as a digital download. Order online at premier.org.uk/shop.
Welcome back to the third and final part of this week's Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate every week. We've been doing that for over 10 years now. And if you'd like to read the story of that, and indeed you'll be able to hear it soon too on audiobook as well, then do get a copy of Unbelievable, the book. Why, after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. I've been thrilled by the reception of the book. And if you want to find out more about it, download a free sample chapter and indeed get yourself a signed copy of the book from our website. Then do check out unbelievablebook.co.uk. Something very special on Unbelievable this week. We'll be returning to the final part of the live audience version of the show we did down at Creation Fest in Cornwall. Before we get to that Q&A section, though, just a reminder that straight after today's programme here on Premier Christian Radio, you can hear Dr. Michael Youssef in conversation with Dave Rose on The Profile. Michael Youssef heads up the radio ministry Leading the Way, which broadcasts not only here on Premier Christian Radio, but around the world, and is reaching many people in Arab countries as well. He'll be talking about that and the ministry between 4 and 5 with Dave Rose. Next week on Unbelievable, politics and evangelicals will be under discussion in what is a panel debate on the subject, looking at the differences between UK and US evangelicals. And there are some pretty stark ones when it comes to their political preferences. We'll be hearing from Andrea Hatcher, who's a academic out in the US who's been writing a book researching that whole area, and a number of other people joining us both from the US and the UK for reflecting on that. Should be a really interesting edition of the programme at the same time next week. Right now it's time to head back to the audience at Creation Fest, where we recorded this conversation on stage. Why I'm a Christian, why I'm a humanist. My guests were Andy Bannister, a Christian thinker and apologist, and Mark Preedy of the Cornwall Humanists. So we threw it open to the audience, and this is what happened in the Q&A section.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
It's always the way on Unbelievable. We could carry on these conversations all afternoon if we could. I can see lots of hands already raising around the tent, so we'll see to how many we can fit in the next 20 minutes or so. We've got a roving mic here. Simon is on the mic. There's a gentleman right at the front here and can I just ask you as well, do keep your questions nice and short, to the point. Hand the microphone back once you've asked it, and I'll give an opportunity to both our guests to respond to your questions. Thank you.
Yeah, hi. My name's Rob. I like sailing. I've been around lovely islands. But what do you say to someone who, when things don't go well, your career goes down, your marriage goes down, you get cancer, your children get cancer? What hope do you have to give them?
And you're asking this, obviously, to Mark, our humanist guest.
And before you answer, I wasn't brought up as a Christian. My parents were quite well off. I went to a very good school. But nothing of that helped.
Okay.
I tried everything, and the only one thing that helped me at the end was faith in Jesus Christ.
Thank you very much for the question. So, Mark, yeah, the question essentially, what happens when life doesn't, you know, give you a life where you can sail the world and enjoy, you know, things?
Well, it depends on your perspective. I'm not going to suddenly start saying, well, I'm sorry, I don't believe in God and, you know, tough luck.
Yeah.
Life is full of ups and downs. There's no reason. There's just crap that shit happens. But yeah. Well, there is. Well, when you say hope, I mean, I have hope. No,
we'll
I have hope. I have hope in, I suppose I have hope in the long term, that we can have a fairer society, that some cancers can be, and there's always advances in medicine, that we're getting better, we're living longer, and that's not because we're living longer, it's just more of us are living to the same age as what we used to, or that we can do, basically. So this idea that we're living longer, it's not, it's just more people surviving childbirth, we're living, yeah, and so okay, good example. I was there when my mum died, all right? She was in a coma. She had breast cancer. She had a coma for four weeks. She had death rattle, which is when it was a convalescence. She was dying. And they kept on saying every night, tonight she's going to die. So the whole family stayed around. And she didn't. She kept on going, basically, for 2 weeks. And until one night, I can remember having a conversation with Mum, because she knew she was dying for some time. So we had a conversation about what she had hoped and what she had... And I always promised her that I'd look after... Because she got a younger daughter that was about 10 years younger, my sister. So that was who she concerned. Because I was 20 at the time, sister was 10. So she cared more. She had more concerns about her outcome of the situation of her dying. So, and she just said, I don't want everyone gawping at me when I'm dying. I just want to die on my own and quietly. So this final night, the night before, I just convinced the family to go home. And me and my uncle Malcolm was left in the room. And it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, he went, I'm going to the toilet. And he went off to go to the toilet. I just sat down next to my mum, because quite happy that she's mostly still here. And I said, Mum, you're on your own now, and I'll look after Faye. And as I said it, she went. And it was, for me, a real life-changing experience, because it made me question my own mortality and realise that it was a beautiful experience at the time, because I was there on my own. I helped my mum fulfil her wishes on her dying bed, which for me was a privilege. It was the saddest thing, obviously, I've done. But I get solace out of it, because that helped her with what she wanted. And that's where humanism is generally a lot about.
Just
people live through their lives, and they have continuation through the people that we are and the memories we have on them. And that's the hope I have, that people think fondly of her, have a laugh about her when they talk about her.
Thank you for that story. It's a great story. I mean, just very briefly, 30 seconds really.
Andy,
what would you respond on that one?
Yeah, I think it's a great question you asked. And it's interesting that the powerful story that Mark told of his mum there. There's a wonderful writer called Julian Barnes, who's written all kinds of novels and bits and pieces. He's an atheist. And Julian wrote a book a few years ago now about death and the experience of getting older and facing his mortality. And he called his book Nothing to Be Afraid Of. I believe that's the title, Nothing to Be Afraid Of. And it's a clever title, because when you first look at it, you think, oh, he's saying that death is nothing to be afraid of. But you read on, and it's the opposite. He's saying it's nothing to be afraid of. Because he picks up on that very point that Mark made there and says, you know, as a writer, you want to be remembered. And I kind of told myself, well, okay, when I die, my work will live on in my fans. And then he said, it suddenly hit me, well, no, because you'll eventually be forgotten. How many of us know the names of our great-great-great-grandparents? Answer, probably very few of us. Few of us, maybe. But eventually, you will be forgotten. You will not live on. And everything that you fought for and everything that you've stood for collapses. He also, in that book, plays with, and I'll just leave my answer here, the idea that some worldviews have a habit, I think accidentally in some cases, of treating individuals a bit like a cog in a machine. You know, my goal is for society to become fairer. Well, that's all very well, but what about the individuals that make it up? It's one of the questions I ask my Muslim friends very often. They want, you know, that society be more Islamic. But what about individuals? And I'm also very careful when I catch Christians being a bit too zippy around this. The question we need to find is not just hope for society, but hope for you and hope for I. And my story is probably the same as yours in asking it, that I think the more I've looked at the options of going, the only place I see hope is if the Christian faith is true. And if it isn't, there is no hope. And it's the honest thing to do is to recognize that, rather than sort of tell ourselves fairy tales and, you know, unicorns and rainbows and sort of, you know, this Pollyanna view of life. It's one of the reasons I like people like Nietzsche.
We'll take another question. Hands all over everywhere. But again, keep it short if you wouldn't hand the mic back.
First of all, Mark, thank you for coming to an away crowd. I appreciate that. you spoke very movingly of when your mother died. As I understand it, an atheist or a humanist would say, a human being is a very well-organized collection of atoms, you know, with functions to keep itself organized and reproduced. So when your mother died, and I appreciate that it was a very moving time for you, did anything happen other than your mother's body became a bit less well-organized and a bit less functional, so it could no longer maintain its organization? Or was there something else there as well?
I guess it's a question about whether we are more than matter in the end. Well-organized matter, albeit.
As far as I say, we're human. It's no different from a dog dying to a human dying in that sense, that, you know, it's void of life, and life is the emergent, you know, it's just the act of breathing and living. So once you stop breathing, you're not living. But you're still part of life because you're decomposed and so forth. But for me, when my mum died, it was experience, and I was the one who's still living on, so I saw that, I felt that experience. I can't say anything. There wasn't any, you know, I suppose the release of a soul or anything like that. I don't believe in, I'm not a dualist, so I'm a monist. I believe in we are the mind, and we're here on this planet for a short time, and there's no difference after death. Is no different from me before I was born. There's no difference between that. So yeah, I didn't feel any sort of, and I can't say I was actually identified as a humanist there.
When it came to the emotions you experienced, obviously, yeah, at that very, as you say, emotional moment, what was it that changed for you? If it was simply, you know,
Well, at the time I was a, for me, at the time I was a policeman, and I wanted to be a policeman because I had these, I liked the certainty of the 25 or 30 years service you made. I liked that I joined because I wanted to help people, wanted to be help society live a good life, as it were. And at the time, it wasn't until after that, I didn't want the certainty. And that's what changed me. I sort of saw, it opened my eyes to, I suppose, because my mum didn't really, she always restricted her life through the fear of what other people would feel about her choices, basically. And it really made me open up to that. I suddenly went, actually, I don't want to know what I'm going to, I don't want to know what I am, what I'm going to be in 30 years' time. I want to explore the world. I want to see the world. And that's what got me into sailing, really, and travelling and seeing the world. So, you know, and I went from being, for me, it was a great experience because I enjoyed being a policeman. You do see a bit of a dark side of life, and the humour of a policeman does become a bit dark, and perspective could be a bit tainted by that. But then I used to shoot sperm whales with a crossbow to collect tissue samples. And I've seen blue whales, I've seen pods of 1,000 dolphins mixed with humpbacks breaching left, right and centre, red barrel riding humpback with a calf. And I've experienced those things because of that change in that. And I could identify that point in time as a, actually, I don't want to know. Yeah, so it was quite it's an uplifting moment. So,
is there any
that
comment?
Was only through my experience, really. I can't say anything on my mum's.
Is there
part.
A comment you'd like to add on the back of that, Andy?
I think it's certainly my appreciation of dolphins, actually, having had that similar experience, which is amazing. A couple of things briefly. I mean, one is interesting, your little throwaway remark there that Mark made about it, you know, one sense of human dying is no different from a dog dying. Of course, the interesting thing is humanism itself is predicated on there being something significant about humans. It's been critiqued that way. So Peter Singer, who's an atheist ethicist, has said that humanism is speciesism. And then you mentioned the British Humanist Association. I had a lovely dialogue with Andrew Copson, who's the head of the British Humanist Association, at Hull University in March, an event like this. Really interesting. During the Q&A, I pushed Andrew on whether he thought there was something unique about humans. And actually, you can look this up, you can watch the debate on YouTube. Really interesting. He said, you know what? He said, it makes me uncomfortable, but I think I am a human exceptionalist. I think I have to say there is something different about us and my humanism to hold. But just on the experience story, let me tell a very quick story, and then we can take the next question. You know, it was very interesting. I remember the day my daughter was born, 4.5 years ago. And it's interesting, some of these life and death experiences shape you. I can remember the moment my daughter was born. I can remember holding her in my hands thinking, gosh, my life has just changed. And anyone who's a parent would go, yes, understatement. I remember holding her in my hands thinking to myself, do you know, if I believe that human beings are just atoms and particles and time just plus chance plus natural selection, a cosmic accident, etc., I guess my emotion now should be, whoopee, well done. I have passed on my selfish genes to the next generation. Chalk one up to Darwin. But that was about as far from the experience of parenthood as it was possible to be. It was just like, it wasn't within a telescope's view of that experience. I remember on that day just sort of having reinforced that whole sense of, you know, what you believe really matters. because it's at times like birth and death. And when tragedy comes, that really you discover if what you believe holds true. Not for nothing did Friedrich Nietzsche say, he who has a why to live for can bear almost any how. And it's when those really tough times of life, as well as the really joy-filled times of life, I think we find out if what we believe is true.
Can we bring the microphone down to our friends at the front here? Because we do have some folk from the Cornwall Humanists. So let's have at least one question from these
guys.
Yes,
at least one.
Go ahead. My
name's Peter. I'm a member of the British Humanist Association and member of the Cornwall Humanists. I'm also a volunteer pastoral worker with the chaplaincy at Trillis Hospital. And I've been with many people who have been at the end of their lives. Mm. Quite often, you realise that 50% of people in hospitals are non-religious. And I've supported many of them as they've gone through their last days. They don't seem to need another presence. They're quite brave. They're able to take their atheism with them to the grave. I'm always reminded of that Mark Twain comment. I was dead for billions of years before I was born. It mattered not an iota to me. And the same will happen to me after I pass. That was the observation I wanted to make. Mm. I wanted to ask a question of Justin, really.
To me? Or to Andy? To Andy, yes.
Andy, sorry.
I'm up for answering questions too, but...
Not Mark. You can ask this as well. I've recently discovered Facebook. And in Facebook, you probably know that there are discussion groups. And there's a couple I belong to, atheist versus theist discussion groups. And I've been engaged with one chap who's a devout Christian for probably the last couple of weeks. And I've asked him continuously for any evidence for his God. And he hasn't been able to provide me with any. So I was very interested to hear you say, on the balance of evidence, I believe in Christianity. So that smacked me in the face. And I thought, well, I'm going to hear the evidence today. Okay. So can you give me some evidence, please?
Okay, thank you very much for the question. That's a whole seminar's worth of a question. But do you want to give a very, very brief... potted history.
Absolutely. Well, what I'll do as a framework, and I'll try and do this in sort of 90 seconds to 2 minutes. I'll use a framework I used back in January. I did a debate at the University of Toronto with the Emeritus Professor of Philosophy there. And actually, the title of the event was, Is Christianity Rational? And so I, at that point, set out 5 lines of evidence. There are about, I'd say there's about sort of 60 or 70 lines of evidence one could set out. So we could easily make this an entire afternoon. And in fact, the demonstration that's... Well, I'm going to answer it. Well, actually...
So well, just because well, that won't have come through the microphones...
Well, now, the gentleman has just said atheists would disappear overnight if there was evidence. That is a classic example of a horrifically bad argument, with all due respect. Because the flip side is true. If there was no evidence for Christianity, all the Christians disappear overnight. And then I have someone like Thomas Nagel, very well-regarded American atheist, who said, it's not that I don't believe there's a God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want there to be a universe. Or Aldous Huxley, who said, the reason I'm an atheist is because I chose a particular kind of lifestyle and I wasn't comfortable where Christianity led. So human beings are far more complex than simply believing heads on a stick, is the first thing. So that evening at University of Toronto, I offered 5 lines of evidence. I talked about the fact that science works, the fact that mathematics and physics fit so well together. So Eugene Wigner's famous paper from the 1960s, The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics. See, if there is no God, numbers are just a human invention. They were something Mesopotamian goat herders came up with sometime around about the second millennia BC to count their sheep. Why is it that numbers plug so well into the laws of physics? Why is it that we have a mental reality underlying physics? Interestingly, my atheist friend that evening actually said that's a very good argument, to which I don't actually have an answer. Now, you can argue how far you can push that. That is a huge difficulty for naturalism, is not in dispute. Secondly, I would talk about cosmic fine-tuning. On his show a few weeks ago, Justin had Luke Barnes, who's an atheist astronomer, and I forget the co-author of his book.
This is going back a bit further, actually. Luke Barnes is the Christian astrophysicist. And,
that's right. We
were talking about things about fine-tuning
anyway,
the multiverse.
Yeah. Luke and his fellow Australian physicists. It's a fascinating book. They've written a book called, remind me, A Fortunate Universe.
That's right.
Is the book. It's a fascinating book because here you have two physicists. One is a Christian, one who's an atheist, arguing about the fact the laws of physics are very, very precisely fine-tuned for existence. And interestingly, it wasn't Christians who came up with the fine-tuning arguments. It was a non-religious physicist in the 1970s. They actually agree all the way through the book that the universe is fine-tuned for life. They agree that all the traditional answers that people like Richard Dawkins and others would advance to explain them don't work. The last chapter is where the disagreement comes out on, does the conclusion lead to God? But they agree that it points somewhere quite interesting. So I would say the fine-tuning of the laws of physics. Thirdly and fourth, I'll give you three more because you wanted lines of evidence. Thirdly, the moral argument.
Sorry, can
fourthly,
I just,
the argument from consciousness. And
we will come to you
the
as well.
Resurrection of Jesus.
Just go one at a time and then...
Exactly.
If you went back to, say... four lots of generations before you were born, so your great-great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents, there'd be, 64 of them? So for you to exist, they would have to live their life as they did. And we know they did, because you're here, aren't they? So a retrospective look at things had to be for you to come about is always going to look like there was some purpose, but you can't go back to those 64 grandparents, the great-great-great-grandparents, and say, what was your aim? Was it to have me? so that's the kind of cosmological...
So that's your response to the fine-tuning.
It's the same function. It's like, just because things do exist for you to exist doesn't mean they were there with any purpose.
With you in mind.
That's a great response. Yeah. It doesn't... With respect, it doesn't work for a number of reasons. One, of course, is the numbers are so astronomical. You mentioned the whole stardust thing. You know, Fred Hoyle... Very famous.
Sorry, I missed that.
You mentioned the fact we are stardust.
We came from
stardust. Excited
about
this. Stardust is interesting because Fred Hoyle, in fact, he was the physicist who coined the term Big Bang. Very, very strident atheist. But he was one of the early ones to point to the fine-tuning issue because he said when you look at the laws and the laws of physics that govern nuclear fission in the heart of stars that produce the particles that make us. This was his conclusion. He said, you come very quickly to the conclusion that somebody has monkeyed with physics because it's an obvious setup. He said, it's laughable. It's so obviously a setup. Where it went, he wasn't willing to say. Your analogy about parents, there's a Canadian philosopher called John Leslie.
You're saying there that the stardust that we are, that sun or star has exploded with the purpose. So then saying, look, we're going to come about.
No, Mark,
in
with all due respect, you're misconstruing the argument. What Fred, who's on your team, not mine,
you're attacking atheist or assuming somebody who's an atheist.
But let me talk about your grandparent analogy. The grandparent analogy is interesting. To go, John Leslie, who's a Canadian secular philosopher, gave a lovely illustration that helps us clarify what we're talking about with fine-tuning. He said, let's imagine that you're captured during wartime, taken out, tied to a post, and then 50 crack marksmen line up to shoot you. And the commandant goes, 1, 2, 3, fire. And you hear 50 guns shoot out. And you hear those shots die away, and you realize you're still alive. And every single one of them has missed. Now, it's clearly the case that if they hadn't all missed, you wouldn't be here. That goes without saying. But that there is still something that requires explanation is obvious. There is still a mystery. There is still an obviousness to the fact that something requires explanation. And the fact that physicists almost universally recognize a fine-tuning phenomena tells me we're onto something.
Yeah, but I think you're... that's where... I mean, I suppose I'm a part-time... I mean, you've obviously done philosophy, but part-time... I enjoyed philosophy in ways that you learn what questions are valid and not. And a why question is, why has it come about? It's two parts to it, isn't it? There's a what for and how come. So the stardust analogy is how we have come about. And it, just because something's come about in a way doesn't mean it has a what for. There's no there's no reason why you need to have those. So that's why questions get a bit distorted, and sometimes you can't.
We are going to have to start to draw things to a close.
I wasn't expecting to get into a full-on fine-tuning debate, but the why question doesn't mean there's an answer. And often you have to say, well, it's just there is no why. There is a why in that's how it's come about. The what for is either there's no what for. Or we don't know.
Unfortunately, we're not going to have time for your other lines of evidence. but do you want to just a quick response, and then we'll take one more question, and we'll
as I say, on the fine tuning, your show with Luke Barnes is worth looking up. It's a fantastic book, and say co-written with an atheist. And then, as I say, where I landed that night at University of Toronto would be the primary piece of evidence for Christians. Would of course be the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. And I think you can mount an incredibly powerful historical claim. I mean, by training, I'm a historian. You can mount a powerful historical claim for the resurrection.
And if it's not too much of a dreadful plug, all of these areas are covered in my book. Obviously, you're welcome to look into that.
And Mark and I are on 10% commission for any copies that are bought, Justin kindly said.
I do appreciate the question, and sorry that a Q&A is not the ideal moment to get into such huge issues, but perhaps we'll continue it afterwards. Okay, we'll take one more. We haven't had a lady yet. Have we got any ladies in the audience? There we go. Hey. Let's have... Okay, go ahead.
Hi. My name's Nikki. Forgive me, I'm not a historian, a philosopher, or anything, but I've really been enjoying your conversation. Mark, my question is for you. You talk about fairness and equality, yeah? And say that's
the... Sorry, can you say it again?
Fairness and equality, that's the primary humanism philosophy, is that right? Or that's...
Those are the prime values held dear by humans, let's
and,
say. Yeah.
And you said there's nothing better, you've got nothing against bettering yourself, and the laws are there to uphold that fairness and equality. Is that, have I understood that correctly before I ask my question? So if that's the gist of it...
So well, that's what I mean. You don't have to be a humanist to believe that.
Yeah,
I mean, in fact, humanism is non-political, really. Yeah. There is no political affiliation.
Great.
Humanism has led me to have that view that we should have...
Okay, so what's your question?
So my question is, if there's nothing wrong with bettering yourself, it's two parts to my question, is how does that... Once you've bettered yourself, then you're not equal to any others again, presumably. And why bother bettering yourself? If the laws are there to uphold the bare minimum, why strive to be more? And if you then raised that level of moreness, if you like, how does that then make you equal? Because then you are entitled to things, or you have access to things that makes it unfair.
We live in a world, a society which naturally...
Life is unfair, you're quite right. Yeah. Life is unfair. The best thing... there's all political spectrums, and at the end of the day, we've got to assume that everybody... They should be born equal. I mean, unfortunately, we're not. Some people are born with money, some people aren't. But as a society, we should be giving everyone a chance to fulfil their life to the best they can. And unfortunately, not everybody has the desire to do that. They don't want to. We can't say that we should force them to either. So at the end of the day, we've got to give the opportunity to have that ability to fulfil your own wishes and desires. People change through life. I mean, I'm not the same person I was when I was 10. I wasn't the same person when I was 20. And when I say better, I mean, I'm better myself because I feel happier about myself and happy in what I do. And I try and help other people to do that. I can't see the problem of that. Even if I feel I've bettered myself in some aspects or some way in life, shouldn't mean I can look at somebody else saying, you can't have that right to do it as well. We should provide that ability to do that. And I can't see anything...
Final comment, Andy, and then we'll draw this to a close.
Final comment. That was a great question. And what was interesting, I was fascinated by your response there, Mark, because just a moment ago you were telling me don't jumble up what and why questions, that there are what questions and there are why questions, and about be suspicious of why questions, and then suddenly we're now leaping from an ought to an is, because it is the case that life is unfair and the scales are tipped and some have lots and others don't, but it ought to be the case that we strive for a fairer world. It ought to be this, it ought to be the other. One of the huge problems is you can't get from an is to an ought. The world is desperately unfair, and the question is, why ought it to be otherwise? And if we live in a world that is just atoms and particles, then it is the fact that some people are going to get hurt and damaged, and there's nothing you can do about that. On the other hand, if there is more to life than that, if human beings do have a value, they do have a dignity, there is such things as good and evil, we live in a universe in which things like justice really have meaning, not preference, then we can talk about ought. And we can go out and fight for justice. And I'll fight for justice alongside my humanist friend, alongside my Muslim friend, alongside my friends of all faiths and none. But I believe these things really do exist. And I believe human beings have value and dignity because we were created in the image of a God who gave us incredible value and dignity and demonstrated that value and dignity when in the person of Jesus Christ he died for each one of us, paying an incredible price for each one of us, which means that there is an impetus there to stand up for justice and fairness because there is a way the world was supposed to be. Some things are really wrong and some things are really right.
We will leave it there. Can we just have a round of applause for both of our guests today?
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this special edition of Unbelievable, which was recorded live at Creation Fest in front of an audience there with Andy Bannister and Mark Preedy. And didn't they do a great job? You want to find out more about Andy Bannister? solus-cpc.org. And for Mark Preedy and the Cornwall Humanists, that's cornwallhumanists.org.uk. And we would welcome your responses to what you heard on the programme today. If you'd like to email in, I'll try and read out some of those responses in future programmes. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. If you'd like to send me your thoughts via social media, you can find me on Twitter at UnbelievableJB to follow the show there. Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to follow the show on Facebook. And I'm more than happy to hear your thoughts that way as well. You can find today's show online, of course, at the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Feel free to leave a comment there as well. Share it on with friends and, of course, access the podcast and all the other features and other bits and pieces available, including the book and conference DVD too. Thank you for being with me on Unbelievable, and thanks to all those who were involved at Creation Fest, both the audience and the organisers, especially Sarah Yardley, who did such a fantastic job pulling together such a brilliant, diverse, creative and engaging programme for Creation Fest this year. There's still another date that you could add to your diary, though, if you're up in Scotland. Creation Fest Scotland takes place in George Square, Glasgow City Centre, on Saturday the 26th of August from 12 noon to 8 p.m. That would be well worth getting along to. Loads of bands, speakers and great stuff for families going on there in Scotland on the 26th of August. For the moment, coming up next on The Profile, Dave Rowe speaks to Dr. Michael Youssef of Leading the Way. And here's what's coming up on the show next week.
You're unbelievable.
Fascinating panel discussion on politics and evangelicals and how the US and UK evangelicals are very different when it comes to their political habits. Andrea Hatcher is the academic who'll be talking to us about her research in this area, and we'll have contributions from other people like Andy Flanagan of Christians in Politics, Andy Walton, a Christian journalist and political commentator, and also John Smirak of The Stream in the US. So look forward to you being with me again for the show that gets you thinking every week, Unbelievable.
Lo sabe que ahora más que nunca buscas el precio más bajo. Por eso, cuenta con nuestra garantía de precios bajos para obtener lo que necesitas a precios competitivos para tus proyectos. Y si encuentras un artículo igual a un precio más bajo que califica, te lo igualaremos. Lowe's. Nosotros ayudamos. Tú ahorras.
Igualación de precio aplica al artículo igual con un precio actual en tiendas calificadas. Aplican términos y exclusiones. Detalles en lowes.com/garantía-precios-bajos.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance, like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.